No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote.
Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People the Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show, which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. And I'm joined by my co-host, Marilia Duffels. And together, we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So welcome to the show and Happy New Year. Let me introduce the greatest gift I got in 2021, my co-host, Marilia Duffels. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, Mike. You are far too kind. I really
You're the best, really. I'm so glad to have you with me. And here we go into it. It's 2022. I mean, I just can't believe it. It's hard for me to even say it.
I know. It's crazy. I'm barely getting over that 21.
Yeah. And we lost some important people this week, and we're going to talk about one of them that you actually met. But first, let me say that I've had for the past 60 years, probably, a crush on Betty White. I thought she was the funniest, most talented person there. I fell in love with her when she was the slutty food show person, cook on the Mary Tyler Moore show.
Oh, when she had
and you know, so she passed at 99, like 10 days short of her 100th birthday. What an amazing career. So just wanted to give a shout out to her.
Absolutely.
And then we also lost, of course, an icon in for anybody that's ever fought for civil rights, and that's Archbishop Desmond Tutu. He was an Episcopal priest, winner of the Nobel Peace Prize, an advocate for social justice and LGBT rights. He helped bring down apartheid, the most heinous case of racial injustice on the globe, and certainly will be missed. And Marilia, you actually got a chance to meet him, which I find astounding.
Honor and a privilege to have met him. And he was just as he is portrayed by the media and the press. He just had a heart of gold. There was no barrier between him and any human being. I mean, he saw straight through your heart and your humanity. And he was funny. He was just a light-hearted soul. And it's just such a tragedy that we lost him, because, wow, what a unique and valuable human being he was.
Well, you know, isn't that something that in politics you see this sometimes, that, you know, we talk about it. We talk about people that have a presence. They just walk into a room and they attract attention. And I think one of the most attractive qualities, probably the single most attractive quality in any human being, is someone who's exactly like you explained, comfortable in their own skin, who's, you know, you just get a warm feeling being around some people like that. And I never had the honor to meet him, but it's nice to know, you know, because sometimes you meet people and they're not what you think they are. you know?
Exactly right. Exactly right. And he didn't have to portray anything because he was who he was on its face, and he didn't act with any superior airs. And he had, not that anybody really has a right to, but you almost wouldn't blame him. But the other thing that he had that pervaded his soul in life and in death was humility. And it's something that a lot of politicians and famous people can learn from. You know, just the fact that he left word or instructions for his coffin to be the simplest possible is testament to that. And so, you know, even in death, the man exudes humility, and it is an asset that we should all have. And my hope for 2022 is that has served as a symbol, and that will infect humanity, and especially current and future leaders.
Yeah, I think that's a beautiful sentiment. And, you know, all I can tell you is I think that the people, maybe people who stand up for the rights of others, gain this humility. I was, yes. I was behind stage at the convention in 1980 in New York City, and I met, I'm sorry, in 1990 in New York City, and I met Rosa Parks, and she was standing in a corner, and I saw her, and nobody was even with her, and I said to the woman who was with me, we were both working the stage, who is that? And she said, Rosa Parks, and I said,
wow,
Rosa Parks, Rosa Parks, Rosa Parks, and she went, yeah. And she was this little tiny woman. I guess I expected her to be like a big, you know, person given what she had done. But again, I went over and introduced myself, and she was very nice. And you know, so yeah, some people just get it, but a lot of politicians don't do that. It's all about the power. It's all about it's all about themselves.
Yep.
And you know, another woman I met one time during a hearing was Dorothy Height, and she thanked me for my activism. And I came home and I said to my wife, I can't believe she thanked me for my activism, you know, given who she is. But you know, those people, right? They know who they are, and they exude that. And God, you're so right. We need so many more of them in the world.
Because a lot of politicians have a lot to be humble about.
That's right.
To be boastful about. It's quite the opposite. And the problem is, you know, there are the sycophants who prop up that mentality, that ego. And it just it furthers.
Yeah, unfortunately, we've known a few, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah, on both sides of the issues.
We've known lots of few.
Yeah, unfortunately, but I've got to tell real quick my Desmond Tutu story, because I went to I helped train Native Americans that wanted to run for public office, and we've done this a couple of times, and it's worked pretty well. And we had this guy from New Zealand whose name was Hone. I can't pronounce his last name, but he told this story. He got up, and Hone was a radio show host, just like you and me, in New Zealand. And he found out that the South African rugby team was coming to play the New Zealand state rugby team, and everything was being paid for by the New Zealand government. Well, it was apartheid, and he thought this was wrong. He's a Maori, and he thought it was wrong for his government to support this team from South Africa. So he started to go on radio and talk about it. And he talked about it for a while, and then the game came to pass, and he said that people should come to the stadium and protest the game. Well, unbeknownst to him, thousands of people showed up. Thousands of people protested the game. They almost shut it down, but they didn't. And he was arrested. Well, he ends up in court. He ends up in court, and he goes before the judge, and the judge says, "Where's your lawyer?" And he says, "I don't have a lawyer." And the judge says, "Well, I got bad news for you. You're facing, you know, 20 to 30 years in jail for insurrection, and you need to get yourself a lawyer." So he didn't know what to do. So they put him in jail. He was there overnight. He heard that Desmond Tutu had come to New Zealand, had come to the capital to do something. I don't know what. But he got a note to a Maori guard and said, "Please get this to Bishop Tutu and tell him I need his help." Now, what are the chances that that would actually happen? But he's in court the next day. The doors swing open. And in walks Desmond Tutu with an entourage.
Amazing.
Amazing. So he puts Tutu on the stand and he says to him, he's not a lawyer, he doesn't know what to do. And
right.
He says, "Tutu, have you ever been, Archbishop Tutu, have you ever been arrested for protesting apartheid the way I did?" And Tutu says, "No." So he doesn't know what to do. He's like flabbergasted. You know, where do I go now? And so he just says to Tutu, "Well, could you explain to us what apartheid is?" And he said for 10 or 15 minutes, Tutu launches into this explanation of what apartheid is and the effect it has on the people of South Africa. And he says when he's done, members of the jury are crying. The judge is crying. The prosecutor is like, "Oh my God, you know, where do I go from here?" He's found innocent. Of course, they let him off. And he becomes so famous from the incident. The news, everybody in New Zealand covers it. And he becomes so famous that he gets elected to Parliament, to one of the Maori set-aside seats. And I don't know if he's still there. I tried to find out if he's still there, but I had a hard time finding a list of members. But the last time I checked, he was still there. And this was 20 years ago. So 10 years ago, he was still there. So I think he may still be there, but he was there for a really long time. And you know, so I never really got to meet Desmond Tutu, but I had this fabulous story. And I have to tell you, at the end of the story, yeah, he tells this amazing story and everybody in the room is enraptured by it. And then they say to me, "Okay, Senator Brown, you can get up and talk about statehood right now." And I'm like, "Why? Why do I want to do that? You know, it's like, what am I going to say?" Yeah, I'm a statehood advocate, and I had lunch with Thomas Jefferson, and he said, you know, so I didn't know what to say. I got up there. I think I put everybody to sleep. But this guy was an amazing guy with an amazing story, which just tells you what an amazing person this man was, right? Because it, when the spotlight's not on you, right, that's when you meet a politician and he has no vested interest in being nice to you or doing something for you or right, being gracious, and he is or she is, you say to yourself, yeah, that's the real deal. Those are the moments where you really see what people are. So.
Yep, when they're not looking over your shoulder to find the next person they can
Right. Give
use to them, which is, you know, the disease in Washington.
Right. I always say the easiest way to commit suicide is to get in between a politician and a camera, you know, of any sort. You will be immediately trampled by him and his staff. As the staff drags you out of the way, you know, I mean, but it's unfortunately so true. And we see it so much in D.C. politics, too, you know, as much as we've got people that have just gotten out of jail that are running for re-election. You know, I mean, we have Harry Thomas who's doing that and people are talking about Jack Evans running again. I mean, I just can't imagine, but, you know.
Well, Vincent Gray, too.
Yeah, Vincent Gray was under investigation for 4 years. And now he can be a councilman for life in Ward 7, the way Marion Barry was in Ward 8. You know, and just so that you know, we this is an equal opportunity you know, city. We have guys like Jim Graham and plenty of white guys and black guys who have both gone on the wrong, you know, you should be honored to be elected. It should be a responsibility. It's not about you. It's about the people that put you where you are.
Yep.
And that's what we forget, and we forget it time and time again.
Vessels, and they don't know that. And you can even read about vessels. I'm not saying religion should be into this, but you can. The word vessel is even found in the Bible in this context. And these people are vessels, and there will always be another vessel to replace them that is perhaps even better than what they're doing or not doing. Right. So my goal in life, at least 2022, is to always invoke Desmond Tutu's humility.
Well, that is a great goal. And let us not forget, since you mentioned the Bible, that Timothy tells us in the Bible to be a vessel unto the Lord. That's what that's what he tells us, and we should be.
Absolutely right.
And Desmond Tutu absolutely was, you know. And there are people like that in the world, right, that just exude these godlike qualities,
he treated me as if I were, you know, the most important person to him at that moment, and I felt nothing less. And his wife too was lovely, and so is lovely, and so is his daughter, whom I also had a chance to meet and get to know. She's an amazing artist. His wife and his daughter, M. Pho, not the other one. The other one who spoke at the funeral, I don't know if you saw what she said.
No, I didn't. But
he said that the love, there was a little bit where she said that he said that the love that he gets from people back from the love that he gives to people warmed the cockles of his heart. And he said, I don't know what cockles is. Or means.
Yeah.
But mine have been warmed by your love. So that was a lovely thing she said.
Yeah, and it's true, isn't it? That the more you give to people, what you get back very often is much more than what you give.
Absolutely.
You know, and it seems so simple to me. I don't know why it's so complex, but you know, when I think it, and I don't want to get to bring too much religion into it, but when I think about God and I think what would God want from me, it's so simple for me. He would want me to take care of those people around me.
Right.
I mean, if I had a week left to live and you asked me what you could do for me, I would say, take care of my children. If my kids ever come to you and they need something and you can give it to them, give it to them, you know? And that's what I think she wants from us. I think he wants us to take care of each other.
Exactly.
And I don't know why that's all so difficult. Even
science shows, and I know this because I used to write about neuroscience for The Economist magazine. In altruism, the brain is such, and it works in such a way that the reason altruism feels so good is because it actually stimulates the feel-good hormones, the feel-good neurotransmitters in the brain when we give. They have done studies on that. So altruism is actually a selfish act because it really makes us feel good, literally makes the brain feel good. Science proves that.
Right, absolutely. Yes, and thanks for bringing that up. Because, it does. We've all been through the holidays lately, we've all given, we all feel that, right? When somebody opens a gift that we give them that they love, you know, that they like, it makes us feel good, right?
Yeah, makes you happy.
Well, you know, I want to talk about the future a little bit, and you know, one thing I'd like to talk about is with you, especially because you do have a science background, is that the cover of the Washington Post magazine today was Greta Thunberg on climate change.
Right.
And I just, again, it seems so simple to me that if we don't have climate, we don't have anything. You know, if we don't have if we don't preserve the environment, and, you know, and it was amazing to me. One of the first things she said, which I know you'll agree with, we can't compromise with the laws of physics. That's the first thing she said. You know, to just, you can't negotiate with the laws of physics, right?
Exactly, right. That is well put.
Yeah, because science is science, and you know, you can't say, well, we're going to reduce carbon emissions so much and see we're being better, so the world should respond by getting better, you know, right? You have to reach whatever limit that is where you have to.
You can't.
Yeah, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Science like legislators do. They you can't legislate science. It is what it is, whether it's physics or chemistry. There is no formula that you can tinker with. It'll slap you right back in the face if you try to. And I don't understand. I imagine that people who are against climate change and climate science don't have a science background and maybe have science phobia. And perhaps that's their way of dealing with it. But, you know, maybe we should improve science education in schools, and perhaps people would understand, but there's no way around it. When X plus Y equals a certain number, that's what it is.
Well, I think maybe you're right. Maybe we should do that. As a guy that took his first practical biology exam and looked through 16 microscopes and everything looked exactly the same to me, I think when I got to the final microscope, I said, what are the chances that these are all paramecium? No, I think maybe I better go back. But no, you're right. We do, and we think it's not going to affect us, or we're so selfish and short-sighted that we understand that this is a horrible thing that we pass on more to our children, our grandchildren, than we pass on to ourselves. You know, and so we don't care about it. I mean, look, Senator Manchin. We all understand that West Virginia's got a lot of coal in it, okay? But damn it, when the climate goes bad, it's going to go bad for the people of West Virginia as well as the rest of us. So you need to get on board and sign on to some legislation that's trying to make the world a better place. And I think this is our challenge. I think my father's challenge was saving the world for democracy, and he did that. He fought in the Second World War. He trapped across Europe. They were the greatest generation. They did save the world. But what behooves us? How does it behoove us to save the world and then allow it to degenerate to a point where it's toxic? You know, this is our great challenge, I think.
It's selfless and it's hubris. Yes. And it's also delusional that somehow a magic eraser can pop up and erase all the problems that have been created in terms of the environment and the way it affects us. It has to be. It's selfishness and it's hubristic selfishness on the part of these politicians.
Well, and you understand, right, at the very beginning that when people were saying, oh, you know, it's not really global warming, this is a cyclical thing. Remember those politicians at Capitol Hill saying, oh, every 10,000 years the world goes through this, and we have all this science to prove that, you know. And now that polar bears are showing up in Arizona, you know, they're right? They're all of a sudden, well, yeah, okay, global warming's here, but, you know, yeah.
I think if we could only do a in their backyard, I think people don't, it takes a lot sometimes to get people to believe and especially people with hubris and selfishness. But imagine if these people were one of the 600 people or all of the 600 people in Boulder, Colorado, who just lost their houses. A good friend of mine just lost her house, and it was 6 weeks after losing her husband to the fire. And the reason it did catch is they're saying Colorado, Boulder in particular, has had terrible conditions. The there was a drought and dryness in September. They've had no precipitation. Everything's dry. So when there was the spark, whatever it was, they're now thinking it was a meth lab that sparked the grass. And off it took. The grass was extremely dry because there's been no precipitation. And then there was windstorms that were crazy. And you know what that's like. That took it to the extent that it burned 600 houses.
Well, you know, and we have the people that produce this show. We're in Paradise, California, and they were all wiped out. The show is now produced by the same group of people out of Texas. They moved to Texas, but they lost everything. And the woman that does the social media for this show lost her house, and for the same reasons, you know, that wildfire started. Well, you know, everybody knows what's going on in California. We see it more and more and more. And I remember, you know, I took an environmental science course. I think I cried to get a C in the course, but I took an environmental science course, right? And I remember them talking about this. Now, this is 40 years ago, 40 plus years ago when I'm in college, and they were talking about global warming causing more storms, causing more dramatic storms, causing, you know, hurricanes and wildfires and all these things that are coming to pass now. I remember them talking about it in the environmental science course that I took.
Right.
And, you know.
Yeah,
go ahead.
Yeah, people don't understand science, typically don't understand math. They don't understand that there are statistical analyses that take place of science research. In other words, some sophisticated formulas and analyses that are done over and over in every which way to determine whether or not the scientific research is authentic. Is this a one-off? Is this a random event? Or does this make sense? Is this an actual phenomenon? Whether that's looking at molecular activity on up to climate change, something as big and encompassing as climate change. So statistical analyses are done, different kinds, to every bit of authentic research that there is there. And the other thing, it is peer reviewed. So people don't understand that. They would probably not understand the statistical analysis. It's not simple, but it's not terribly complex either. So
well, and that's it, right? We wallow in our ignorance and we use it as a shield often, you know, like everything. I remember my grandmother, who was the center of my life as a little kid. Everything was an anecdote to her, right? She knew everything about everything because she knew that. Every Irish person was exactly the same because she knew the Irish lady next door and she didn't like her. And that, you know, so anybody, you know, they were all the same, you know, to her or, you know, and we use that as a shield, I think, in a lot of cases. I know that she did. And by the way, my kids gave me a 23andMe, and I just found out that I'm 51% Italian. So,
no.
Yeah.
Oh, that's great. I know it.
It's great for me because, you know, as a kid, I grew up in an Italian neighborhood. I used to say I was the only boy in the third grade that didn't shave. you know, that I always wanted to be Italian. And my name was Mike Brown, you know, and I had all these friends named Giovanni and Tony and I always tried to do everything I could to be Italian, but finally I've been certified and I'm 45% English, which makes sense because my, you know, I have a relative that fought in the Revolution. My father was English and Irish. His mom was Irish. So
right.
But yeah, 51. I just made it 51% of doubt. So I found that very interesting. But anyway, yeah, you know, we could go on and on about climate change, and I hope we'll have some people. We've had some people on the show in the past, and I hope we'll have some in the future. And you know, it'd be great to have you interact with some of those people. And let's talk a little bit about the future. We're going to have some interesting guests. We're going to have the Attorney General for District Columbia. He's going to come on in February. We find out now. We're hoping to have Mary Trump, who's the niece of the former president, on, who's written a book about him. Because this is the big question in you know, what's going to happen to the Republicans in 2022? We saw that we thought that this year, during the special elections, that the Republicans are really going to be hurt by Donald Trump, and that didn't happen. They did pretty damn well. And you know, so we don't know exactly what the situation is going to be with Donald Trump. So it'd be great to get Mary Trump on and see what her take on all this stuff is, because she's been following him his whole lifetime. So
yes, she has. Well, a week is a long time in politics.
Yeah, it really is a long time in politics. And
things will change. Hopefully the star will become more and more dim.
Yeah, you know, I hope that his influence on the party, his hold on the party, because, you know, both of us have been in politics both long enough to know that we need two healthy parties, at least, you know.
Yes.
With the world, like in America, maybe we're going to have a third party emerge, but through independents and other groups. But you need at least two healthy parties, you know.
Brazil, who has, I forget how many parties, but they have more parties than they have states, I'll tell you.
Well, and that's the thing, right? All these people that embrace multi-party governments, I say, you know, that's like Italy is the world's greatest democracy because they let everybody run the country for like 3 weeks. And then, you know, they have so many parties. They're always putting together coalition governments that are falling apart. And that's the beauty of a two-party system, is that you have to coalesce, supposedly anyway, before you actually get to the ballot box. And but I don't know that either party has an agenda the way they used to have an agenda, right? You used to be able to say certain things about Republicans, physical responsibility. They believed in a strong military. They believed in, there were certain things they believed in, and the same thing with Democrats. There were certain basic beliefs in for Democrats, and you know, you just, and I don't see.
It's the old the Venn diagram. You remember the Venn diagram from
school? Yeah.
They've merged. There is no intersecting area. They've merged. It's hard to determine what is really the Republican Party anymore. It's not the old good values that it was, or policy positions. They just don't. Free trade, forget that.
Right. And you know what? I went to a basketball tournament recently, and it was a bunch of schools. There were six schools that played in three different games. And it impressed me. I started to think about how all the fans at the games were going crazy for their team, right? Because it's college sports, right? So you're yelling for your team, and you don't care how they score a basket. You don't care if the guy makes a half-court shot, or he does a layup, or he's fouled, or whatever it is. The whole point is to win. That's all that's important to you is to win. And that's what our politics, I think, has become. We split up into two teams, and we don't care anymore about anything else but winning. That's all we care about. And whereas it may be appropriate for you to go and scream your lungs off for your alma mater, by the way, our alma mater won at the tournament. And I have to shout out, we were in a bowl game recently. We won 51-10 against Virginia Tech. Yeah, University of Maryland Terrapin. Fear the turtle. But anyway. Yeah, but anyway, you know, if we're there, yeah, you scream and you root for the Terrapins. You don't wish any ill will on the other team. You just want to win. You just focus on that. And it seems to me that that's where we've gotten in politics, and it's so inappropriate to get, you know.
You want to win, and you feel for the players. You want your players to win. You want those young guys to win for them. And then you feel badly that the other team is lost. I always feel badly, even if I don't like the other team, like in football. You know, I when I look at them individually after the other team has creamed them, and you know, especially in the Super Bowl, you just feel so badly for them. They're just so down and out with the slumped shoulders. But there is not that in politics. Maybe we could, I doubt it will transfer ever. I doubt it'll be that way, but it's not easy. But that's how it is. You feel sorry for the losing team.
Well, you and my wife, you and Pat Brown, you know, would get along great. That's why I always said she couldn't officiate, because if she was an official during soccer games or whatever, Nick played all the sports, every game would end in a tie. She wouldn't want every game to end in a tie. She wouldn't want anybody to lose, you know.
That's exactly right, Mike.
and you know what? It's strange, really, but I remember that people used to give us dirty looks, because when Nicky was little and he would go play basketball, we would cheer for anybody that made a basket. It didn't matter what team they were on, you know, because the games would end like 10-8 would be the score, you know, and they would shoot at the basket. Because when they were little, they couldn't get an arc on the ball, and like 100 shots would bounce off the rim.
Yeah.
And then one would go in. Who cares? You got it. You know, you cheer for them. And parents on our team would give us dirty looks. Like, what are you doing cheering for the other team? It's like, oh my God, does it really matter? You know, but you know, that's the way we get. And it's just been, I don't know how we break that.
Mm-hmm. Cheering for humanity, like Desmond Tutu.
Yeah, absolutely. Let him be a symbol to all of us. You know, locally we have I want to talk about statehood for a minute, because we're going into 2022. Look, we've blown our opportunity to make DC a state right now. You've got people all over America screaming about voting rights, but nobody says anything about DC statehood. We got two bills before the United States Senate that don't even mention for voting rights, to protect the rights of people to vote. And you don't have even a mention of the 700,000 people who are disenfranchised. And most recently, again, in today's paper, they mention it. It's reared its ugly head again, because we don't have, the Senate is not approving our judicial nominees. So we have a court system in the District of Columbia that's literally got hundreds and hundreds of cases that are backlogged because we can't get our judges, we can't get them approved by the Senate. Now, there's a thing in the Senate that you might be familiar with called red carding, where the senators from the state where the federal judge has been appointed, red card him and say he's okay with us, and the senators generally, as a rule, go along with that. But of course, we don't have that in the District of Columbia, because they don't allow our senators to have any voice at all. You know, right. We're not recognized by the United States Senate. In fact, they recently had a hearing where they wouldn't even let us speak. They wouldn't even let Paul Strauss and I testify. And you know what? We ended up having more than 1,500 people call the committee and request that we be allowed to testify. And they still didn't let us testify, you know.
I was one of them, Mike.
Yeah, I know. God bless you. And you know, so when people in D.C., you know, think that this really doesn't hurt them, it really does. It hurts them in all sorts of ways. And you know what? I think it's the same kind of ignorance that we were talking about earlier mm-hmm. when it comes to science. You know, people mm-hmm. in Northwest Washington who have the power that live in wards 2 and 3 and 6 and 4, we're all doing okay. Our trash gets picked up. Our kids go to decent schools. We live in neighborhoods that are relatively safe. So we don't think about it. We just don't do anything about it. But look, y'all, if you want to get it done, somebody's going to have to stand up and stand behind the people that are working on this and push. The fact that we give almost no money to it, the fact that we don't show any respect for the people that are elected to the offices that are put together to, you know, and an effort to achieve statehood. You know that 6 jurisdictions have had senators like me, and every one of them has become a state. The only one that hasn't become a state is the District of Columbia. And they don't, you know, they don't get that they should support us. But the local politicians see us as competition. So they don't support us. And they try to stand in our way. But the judicial nominations. What? I'm sorry.
Oh, no, that's OK. Sorry. They don't want those 2 extra Democratic votes.
They don't want those 2 extra Democratic votes. That's right. But you know what? If the Republicans are smart enough to oppose it so vehemently because they don't want 2 more Democrats, why the hell don't the Democrats stand up and support it for the same reason that they do want 2 more Democrats, you know? Then we wouldn't have to worry about Joe Manchin, who, by the way, I found out recently drives a Maserati.
No kidding.
Yeah, now you think the people of West Virginia...
No, you know what? I did see something along those lines. Now that you say it. Yeah, right.
Right? That's what the average guy. I've been to West Virginia. Yeah. It would take you a month of driving around West Virginia to find a half a dozen Maseratis. Let me tell you.
A Prius?
And they'd all be people from D.C. who had like summer homes.
Exactly.
Yeah. It wouldn't be. Yeah.
He drives it straight to the Greenbrier.
Straight to the Greenbrier. Exactly. and he talks about how he's, you know, look, every politician was born barefoot in a log cabin. It's the thing that I love.
Driver.
Yeah. It's the thing that I love about all politicians. Pat says to my kids, always used to say, your dad used to walk 10 miles barefoot to school every day, and it was uphill both ways, going and coming. You know, and right, and we're all like hard scrabble, you know, that's one thing. Another shout out, we lost Harry Reid too.
Yeah,
but Harry Reid really was one of those people. Harry Reid grew up in a house without plumbing. He was a boxer. He really was somebody that climbed. And we used to have those people in America.
Exactly. And in Congress.
Right. And in Congress. Right.
And they didn't wear it on their sleeves. They just got on with things.
Right. They did. They just got on with things. It's like, you know, I've got to tell you, the first time I read George H.W. Bush's resume, they used to say he had the best resume in Washington, D.C., I was amazed at some of the things that he had done that he didn't wear on his sleeve. He was the youngest fighter pilot till this day. He's the youngest fighter pilot in the history of the Air Force. Well, it wasn't even the Air Force in those days. It was the Army Air Corps. He was like a 17-year-old fighter pilot. Now, this comes as a shock to a guy that worked hard to get his 17-year-old to take out the trash, you know, that this guy was, you know, right? He stood up for his country. He stood up for America. And you know, if you asked him about it, I think he would have said that it was an honor to stand up for his country, you know? And where have these guys gone? I don't know.
Barely learned how to fly. Learning how to fly is difficult. It's not easy. And they barely learned how to fly. And they were put into those airplanes. And those airplanes, you know, did not have autopilot. They were not like, you know, the latest Airbus where, you know, there's this whole panel and you just click this and click that. No, these things were manual.
Yeah. And they were made out of canvas and, yeah, you know, exactly. And. Yeah, it just.
Yet they did it. It's amazing that many survived. Many died, but it's amazing that many survived. It's amazing that George Bush survived.
Right. And you know what? You're right. It's so hard to learn how to fly. You know that my brother was in Air Force, an F-111. He flew an F-111 in the Air Force, and he just got his private pilot license. And it took him forever to get it. And he failed the test the first time, you know. You know, and now he wants to take me up in his little plane. And I'm like, no, that's okay. I don't even know what kind of plane he's got. They bought a plane. I assume that it's not brand new. I assume it's a pretty old one. But, I think it only has one wing, though. It doesn't have two wings. You know, so I guess that's a good thing. But you're right. It was, you know, these guys had a joystick and a machine gun and a bomb. And, it was amazing. It was amazing what they did.
And imagine with all that around you. Yeah. And smell of the fumes. I mean, you know, it wasn't a sealed cockpit and all that. And you had all this war activity, these planes flying around. You're afraid of being shot. You don't have somebody looking out, and you know, there's no radar. I mean, I don't understand how they did it. I really don't.
It took such great courage, and there were so many people of that ilk from that generation that. Yeah. That stood up, you know, and I know my dad, for example, went, you know, he was in the war for years. It wasn't like Vietnam, you know. Right. A lot of people don't understand. As many men served in Vietnam as served in the Second World War, and it's because the tours of duty were much shorter in Vietnam.
Sure.
And in the Second World War, they just went in and they got out when the war was over, you know. When the war was over in Europe, my father was being sent to Southeast Asia to fight the Japanese, but the war ended, you know. But they were ready to, you know, said, okay, you did what you did in Europe. Now let's go deal with what's going on in Asia. But anyway, I don't know where those people are. I hope there are more of them. I try to. You know, I try to talk to young people and inspire them to stand up. But you know what I hear from a lot of young people is that they're disenchanted with this country that, in my opinion, is so amazing. I mean, I don't get it sometimes. I feel sorry for it because I think that there are a lot of bumps and bruises. You know, we've had plenty of people on our show to talk about things like racism that we know permeates our society and is really, a horrible burden that we need to resolve finally after, you know, 400 years. But also there were great opportunities here. There were great opportunities for me. You know, I wouldn't have never succeeded the way that I have succeeded in any other country I'm convinced of that.
That is the truth. But you also had to fight, Mike. Had to work.
I did, but I threw my life away, and they gave me a second chance. You know, yeah. There's a lot of places where you don't get a second chance. You know, I ran amok in Montgomery County, and I came from North New Jersey, and I ran amok in Montgomery County, and I always said to myself, if I lived in Newark, if I did the same things in Newark I did in Rockville, I would have never survived, you know, because they played for keeps in Newark. In Rockville, they were much nicer, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you were talking about these kids being disillusioned, and I forget what word you use. I mean, imagine if Rosa Parks had adopted that attitude. Imagine if Desmond Tutu had adopted that attitude. These people had to fight. These people struggled. Their families struggled. And I think that's the problem with the young people of today. They don't struggle. They don't have that background of to work for a living, you know, delivering papers at the age of 9. Things.
Right.
And I think it's very easy for them to say, oh, I'm not happy with the system. Well, if you're not happy with it, then fight for it.
Right. I agree 100%. And I know you were a newspaper girl at 9. I think that I was a little older when I started delivering newspapers. I hated it. I hated collecting the money. I always had people that weren't going to pay that, you know, that. I mean, they owed me $1.60, and you know, and they were stonewalling, and
oh yeah,
you know, I hated collecting money from people, but Bill's character really does build character, really does, you know, become something that's substantial from working and understanding how many breaks you get. I think you're right. I think that a lot of these young people don't understand how many breaks they get.
Yeah.
Well, we're almost out of time here. So I say Happy New Year to everybody. As we start 2022, and I hope that we will all focus on climate change and that we will all focus on keeping America, not making it great again, keeping it great, you know?
Yes.
And I give you the last word, my talented scientific co-host.
You're too kind, Mike. You really are. I am humbled by you.
Oh, get out of here.
Let me reiterate, may the spirit of Desmond Tutu infect humanity. That is my wish for 2022 and forever. And may he peace.
Yeah, I can't think of a more beautiful sentiment. So we're going to leave you with the show. And this goes out to all our listeners. I couldn't think of another song to, we're going to leave the show with this song. I couldn't think of another more appropriate song. Here's Imagine by John Lennon.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.